Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to another Just Tennis Talk Show Radio host, All About Tennis. I'm your host, Coach Wes Fuller, along with my wonderful co-host, Susan Nardi. Hey, Susan, how are you?
We're doing wonderful in tennis paradise. How are you?
Pretty good. I mean, since the last time I talked to you, I hear, you know, should I be calling you a director or a CEO or something? I mean, you just have gone from here to, I mean, you just taking over that tennis industry over there down there in that paradise island, huh?
You know what? Yeah. You know, I brought my partner in crime, Ross, with me to Atlanta. You got to meet my bosom buddy there. So, yeah. We're quite the dynamic duo.
That's good. So, Susan, you know, today we have, I guess, a friend of yours, or I don't know if he's a friend or somebody. I don't even know who. I hear so much about this guy. You know, one of our special co-hosts, and you know, I hear his name, Oscar Wegner. You know, I hear this name a lot, and you know, I'm in this forum, this group, this competitive tennis coaches groups, and you know, when Oscar Wegner comes up, his name comes up, you know, you get 200-300 comments and all this. I'm like, well, who is this guy? You know, who is this guy? Then I find out you and him are good friends. And so I'm like, I just want to know who this guy is. So, I thought that it would be great that you got him to come on to the show and to introduce himself and to tell us a little bit about his methodology, his thoughts on tennis, and some of the concepts that he has in tennis. And I really thought it would be really great. So I'm going to hand it over to you and let you introduce our special guest today.
All right. Well, it's kind of an interesting story, and I'll make it really brief. I had been certified through the PTR and PTA and worked for Dennis Vandermeer and a couple other people, and I was working at the Riviera Country Club. And I had this parent come up to me and was trying to get lessons with Rodney Arnfred and couldn't get in, and heard that I was good with kids, and they wanted me to teach the Oscar Wegner way. And I didn't know who, you know, I knew he was a former player but didn't know much. And it started me down a path of wonderment, of amazement, of opening my eyes to a whole new world. And I will never forget the summer of 2004 as long as I live. He's a friend of mine, a dear, dear friend of mine, a mentor. I am just so blessed that when I ordered his DVDs to look at them, to my shock and amazement, he picked up the phone and answered every question I had during every segment of anything that I had a question with. I am just thrilled and honored that CTC gets and Talk Tennis gets to meet my dear buddy, Oscar Wegner. Oscar, are you there?
Yes. How are you, Susan? Good evening.
I'm doing awesome. And you?
Good. Really well. Really well. Here in Florida, a little bit cold at the moment, but it's really enjoying very much, you know, what we do every day, Susan, coaching.
Yep.
Hello, Oscar. Well, how you doing, yeah. Oscar?
Hi.
Let me say, hey, Oscar, how you doing? How are you, sir?
Good to talk to you, Wes. Good, really good.
Good.
How about you?
Not bad. Sitting here waiting for, hear this good, got me some popcorn ready. I want to sit here and hear the story. You and Susan hear some discussion about this MTM and this modern tennis. I just don't understand. I'm back in the old days. I had never heard this about this take your palm, your hand to the ball, the body, all this stuff. I don't know. I'm just sitting here, got my popcorn, got my pen and paper, just going to sit back and relax. So go ahead, Susan.
Well, Oscar, why don't you tell the audience a bit of your story about when and how you came up with find the ball, feel it, and finish the strokes, and how you got started and all that.
Okay. But good. Well, You know, I played the tour from 1963 to 67 until I had an injury, and then I went to California, and when I healed, I started working with Pancho Segura. So this is what happened during the tour, or even earlier, you know, as a kid. I had a huge forehand like Jim Courier, and the coach at the club was trying to be really helpful because I was starting to be one of the best juniors in Argentina. And so he said, well, this is the way you should do it. You should change your grip, you know, to continental. I was using a Western, you know. And I hit a lot of tossing. And then he said, take your racket back, prepare early, step into the ball, and go towards the target. And I was a nice kid, so I listened. The guy was a nice guy, but he was totally, you know, really, unfortunately, wrong because I lost my forehand. And then, you know, I didn't have the huge weapon I had before, but I had a great backhand. I copied my backhand from another great player, you know, Tony Trebek, who won the U.S. Open without losing a set. Then my volleys. Yeah, I copied it from Lou Holt, who was a top player back in the 50s. Then I copied my serve and my smash from Pancho Gonzalez. So I had a complete game effect for my forehand that from a big weapon, now I had to be careful with it. So during the tour, there's so much pressure that I didn't want to change. I played so many top players like John Newcomb, Tony Roach, Roy Emerson, you name it. You know, all the top players. So when I stopped, then I started, like, looking into it and discussing with Pancho Segura. And I said to Pancho Segura, I said, why are we teaching this weird way? Why don't we teach the way we play? Because Segura had a huge forehand, and he had been world champion, you know, in the late 40s, early 50s. So he agreed with me, you know, that we should look into it. So I actually, during the tour, and then later, you know, while coaching with Segura, I had a chance to play, you know, on the tour, especially with the top players in the world. And then, you know, I practiced with Pancho Gonzalez when I was with Segura. He used to come every night. I played like 90 sets with him. And so I started, you know, studying the best strokes in the game. Not one player, you know, everybody, and extrapolate what was better, what was easier, what was more efficient, and added to the point that the pros think in a very simple way. You know, they feel, you know, the memory of a good athlete in every sport is a muscle memory that he develops and he's aware of and keeps repeating it. That's why you say the Pancho Gonzalez, you know, serve, or you say, you know, the Newcomb's forehand or the Feather forehand or the Nadal forehand, and they keep repeating it unless they are forced to change by, you know, wrong data given to them by their coach. So it was easy to see, you know, which way tennis was evolving and who were the best players. So I even practiced with Rod Laver, you know, and I could see, you know, how what he was doing with the ball. And unfortunately, that his ideas were that people should do something different than him, that he was an exception. But it was just that he played in an actually more natural way from my viewpoint. I studied engineering, and also I studied the human body, okay, and I could see which was the easiest way to play. And I started testing it and teaching it, and Pancho Segura loved it. He told me, you know, to continue and do more of it. And he gave me his best students, who were Charlton Heston, you know, Shore, the Kirk Douglas family, you know, in the I was, yeah, Dean Martin Jr., you know, so I was teaching so many celebrities, and they loved it because they started playing consistent, feeling the ball a lot more natural. So that's how I evolved it, and I call it modern tennis methodology. You know, and I say play like the pros, because the best pros were doing what I was proposing. So that's how it started. Go ahead, Susan.
Oh, wow. Are you choking there on your popcorn there, Wes?
Yes, yes. I love it. I love it. So you're sitting here telling me you had a big forehead, Oscar. So you're telling me you had a big forehead, and I guess what you were saying is something that I guess that a lot of so our coach tried to change your forehand to a continental grip, and then you went back to your Western grip.
No, what happens is, well, when I started coaching, but during the tour you feel so much pressure every day. You're playing all these, you know, top players, you know, or all kind of players. You have to beat the lesser players. You have to beat the top players. And I had good matches, you know, where I could say that I was kind of close sometimes, but they would play my forehand. They wouldn't kick to my backhand because I had a great backhand. I could really hit a tossing backhand or a slice. I copied from Ken Roswell, so I had great strokes, you know, except that they knew in my forehand eventually they could break it up. You know, it's like I would miss because I didn't want to show any fear when I'm playing, you know, in front of crowds, you know, and so I hit the ball hard with my margin of error. I had lost the top spin that had made me so good as a kid. So that's why I failed to beat the top players, because with the other forehand, you know, like you saw Jim Courier, you know, being number one in the world because he had a huge forehand. Well, I had a great backhand, great volleys, great serve, you know, and so, but I couldn't make a dent because I had a weakness in my game created by the old style, you know, the conventional style that tell you, you know. Right now it changed, and they call it more conventional because the world has changed. I have, you know, 3 books out and 11 DVDs, and my book is sold in Japan, in China, you name it. My book has been, actually, my first book changed tennis for Russia, for Moscow, you know, for Belgrade, where I coach personally in Spain as national coach and junior Davis Cup captain. And then I coach in Brazil. And then I was on ESPN from 1994 to 1999, and then another channel also for Latin America doing Spanish commentary and also tennis tips and describing the way the pros really played, you know, in knowing that that was the easiest way to play. That's why they were so good. It wasn't that.
What'd you say?
You know, I was teaching Andreas's game. I was teaching Andreas's games before he was even born. Okay? So. Go ahead.
I have a question. Would you say that this just came off the top of my head, just from what you said? Would you tell a parent or someone who's striving to be a pro, or, you know, kids want to be, that there's a different game between that there's a different game that the pros use versus to what they play in the juniors or what they're developed as a, like if I just went to a regular tennis coach, oh, I want some tennis lessons, you know, I want to be good. Are you saying, or is this kind of an assumption that could be made from a parent that there's a different game from regular tennis to the level of tennis that you've achieved, or that high pro level tennis? Are there different methods? Is there a different mythology, or is it just is it that pros feel more? They take what they think, they play more of a off of a feel. than more of a technique or of a technical type of thing where I hear people talk about, well, you want to use this grip and you want to do that. From what I'm hearing from you, pros, do they play more because everything that you've said has been more natural, hasn't been technically, where today you people talk about technical. Is pros playing more off of feel, off of natural instincts because they've done these things so much that they're now part of their makeup? You follow what I'm saying? Does that make any sense?
Here's the answer. In our group of coaches, we have one coach, okay, he is American, but he lives in Hong Kong, and he is a minister. So he was on counseling as a minister in the tour, all the players and talking with them, and then he even was with Roger Federer asking questions, Rafael Nadal, all the top pros. And then he was asking them, as a friend, he said, how did you get to be so good? What was your process? What did you do? And so the guys, in general, the consensus was that they adopted what was easier, what was simpler, and produced the best result. And that I studied in engineering. Yeah, that's how you build a bridge. You go on what works. The best, and then you choose it. You don't try to build a bridge, with spaghetti, all right? Because it's not going to do very well. So anyway, yeah, this is the consensus on the pros. And then it's not very known, and it's unfortunate because here comes a little kid that says, oh, I want to play like Nadal. But in the coaches say, no, you can't play like Nadal. He's a phenomenon, Okay, and the other guys say, I want to play like Djokovic. And in my earlier times, kids came over and they all wanted to play like Andre Agassi. And I said to them, great, this is what Andre Agassi does. And I showed them. That's what modern tennis methodology is. It's how the pros play applied in the simplest way so that a kid, even 4, 5, 6 years old, can be like that because that's how they come into the sport. They admire a great player, which is something that we lost in the U.S. because now we don't have the top players like we had for so many decades. And kids wanted to copy those guys that were number one, number two, number three in the world. Right now, there is a confusion because people think it's much more mechanical that you have to teach the mechanics. But then you make a mechanical player. And a mechanical player, a kid should, for example, move on the court the same way he goes after his dog or running after his dog or trying to catch his cat or playing with his brother. Why would you teach him a certain way of walking when he learned to walk by himself, just grabbing onto the couch, finding his balance? Now, that is what in MTM we do. And Susan can tell you because Susan applies this, I noticed because I've seen her teach fabulously. And so my things align with Susan. It doesn't have to be like Susan aligned with me. She was already doing well, and I just clarified she will know consciously what she did instinctively. So that's what I'm talking about. The tennis is being made complicated. It has been made complicated. It looks like a difficult sport when tennis is one of the easiest sports to learn and to play as well. That's my answer.
Are you okay? Well, I was going to ask him something. Yeah,
go ahead,
Oscar, I wanted to ask you because this is one of the questions that comes up all the time because, I'm a big advocate and a big fan of starting kids off on open stance. And you know, one of my many reasons is because, you know, I wasn't nearly as good of a basketball player as Wes, but I've got some good genes, and I hung out with some pretty good coaches in my time. And I thought that well when I grew up. So, you know, he'd only get one shot, but he'd probably dunk over my head.
Okay, go ahead.
But, you know,
Hold on, there's two people talking over there. I need one question from you, okay. Susan. What is the question?
My question is, can you explain to the audience some of the advantages of why you would want to start a 10-and-under kid, a brand new person, in an open stance? Versus, you know, turning sideways and being in a closed or a neutral stance.
Good. So that's an easy explanation. Okay. The kid, you know, he comes over to you first. You shake hands with the kid, right? Say, hello, nice meeting you, you know? Yeah, I'm going to show you tennis. How does he shake hands with you? Sideways or open stance? First question.
Yeah, he's facing you.
Yeah, he's facing you. Good. And he's facing everything. Okay. And one thing that I'm going to tell you at the side, most kids in the U.S. love baseball. And the minute you put them sideways, they think tennis is like baseball. No, I want to show that it's totally different. You know, okay. So I leave them open stance because that's how it started. And I say, touch the ball, touch your shoulder. You know, so you create the swing. You know, and so, in like you say very beautifully, and I had copied you, you know, put your racket in your backpack. And it works even with pros, okay, Susan. So this is something that has been missed, that if we are not teaching, you know, like open stance. We have a human being in front that shakes hands, you know, with you, open stance, because that puts the hand, his hand closer to you. He may even turn the other way. Instead of close hand, he may go more open because he gets his hand close to you, you know. So why would we put him sideways with his hand farther from the ball? It's harder to find it, you know, it's harder to feel it, you know. In the game, you know, Wes was saying, yeah, tennis is all about feel. You know, they asked Michael Jordan, you know, he says, oh, you have the perfect position when, you know, your body, when you shoot, you know, how you do that? And Michael Jordan responded, okay, in the interview, he said, I have no idea. Okay, all I'm focusing is the ball in the hand, you know, the feel of releasing the ball up there, okay? So the rest of the body was helping his hand, okay, naturally. So that's what we teach. That's why I call it open stance because, I mean, I eat open stance. You know what, I sit down most of the time, you know, but if I'm eating, I eat open stance. I don't go sideways, you know, with the foot on my left, you know, and then having to reach. I probably drop the foot on the floor, okay? So it's common sense.
I want to do a follow-up. When you say open stance, do you mean open? I tend to, just from my experience, I tend to think that people are more between open stance and semi-open, that it's more of a hybrid, and we actually hit more. And even when we shake hands, we're not open stance. Our feet are not. This is just me. I mean, this is just me playing. Our feet are not completely open on straight line. We're more of a semi-open or a hybrid between. We're not a perfect open, but we're not a perfect semi, but it's more in between. Does that fit into your category of what you're saying? Is there a range of open stances, or is it just completely open stance, or is there a range? Because I also see a lot of times, and I mean, these different groups, and we get into these discussions about open stance and closed stance when sometimes I think I'm looking at it, I'm visualizing it, and I'm visualizing that, well, it's not really open, but then they're not really right about it being closed. It's more open than it's closed, and it's the hips. And are we talking about the feet, or are we talking about the hips? See, to me, it's, what is open stance? Is open stance about where our feet are positioned, or where our hips are positioned, or the way our hips are closed or open? Which is, what is the open stance? Did I make?
Well, this is, yeah, you know, you just added another thing, another addition, another complexity to the game. Now you have to think about your feet to go close stance. Then he asks you how you kiss a girl. Okay, I do it open stance. I mean, if you like to kiss a girl sideways or semi-open stance, then you start thinking of your feet. I mean, God.
But do we really know? See, that's my whole thing. If we're looking naturally, we are not observing it. So in reality, we don't really know, because at a certain level, we don't care, because we're putting ourselves balanced. We're not closed. We're not open. We're doing something naturally. So we really, now I'm just looking at the player's perspective, not the coach's perspective. As a player, I don't really know if I'm open or closed because I'm not observing it, because it's natural.
Yeah, exactly. So, but there is advantages to open stance. Then that's why I teach it in the beginning. And then the player, you know, if he came with his feet crooked, he still should play crooked. And if he comes with his feet open, he still will play open. You're not going to change it the way he moves. But there is an advantage to open stance because it's a rotational movement of the body. I'm not talking about rotation of the ball. That's something that can we're not talking about the ball rotation. Talking about rotation of the body. Okay. And I saw a great example of this rotational power. Okay. I saw Muhammad Ali, fighting Joe Frazier. And Joe Frazier got underneath him, and with a rotational uppercut, the guy broke Muhammad Ali's jaw. You know, and then yeah, it was the weirdest thing because he was not the favorite to win, but he really beat him because, what I learned from other sports, even from Bruce Lee. It's all rotation, the body likes rotation.
What starts the rotation? But my point is that what starts the rotation? Is it the open stance of the feet or is it the hips? Because to me, open stance.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So the feet.
It's the feet. To me, the focal point of open stance, the feet can't be straight. I agree with that. They can't be straight. But whether or not it's completely open or a little open,
Here. Hold on one second. It's not just the close or open stance. The stepping into the ball with the left foot, okay, locks the left leg, and that's how people get, injuries. And that's what happened to Serena Williams. Yeah, Patrick Moragues is coaching us to step into the ball. Let me finish. Patrick Moragues coaching to step into the ball, that has locked the left knee and then it's killed her left knee. I mean, I hope she can play Australia. You know, I don't even know. You see, this is the thing, that left foot forward, okay, you transfer the weight. While in my schools or in my school of thought, I taught QWERTYing to load on the right foot and then lift the left foot so he could rotate. And then, unfortunately, he was coached with Larry Passos, who was trying to close his stance just the way you're saying. But when Quarton played his best, his left foot was
I'm not
there.
Close stance.
Serena, the
you're
same
missing.
Thing.
No, you're missing what I'm saying, Oscar. I'm not saying close the stance. I'm saying that I hear everybody talk about the focal point about is on the feet. To me, the feet are not what initiates the rotation of the racket. It's the hips. So it's what's more important that the hips are in a rotational manner than the feet. They don't have to be perfectly open to get the hip. I hear people every time. I'm always hearing open stance. Well, if it's the open stance, the feet have to be here. Well, isn't the feet have to be perfectly there? Isn't it that they have to be in some? To me, they have to be in some variable range that allows your hips to start the pull, because the hips initiate the pull, not the feet. Am I correct?
Well,
am I wrong?
No, you're right, but here is the biggest misconception of all that we haven't touched upon yet, is the stay down through the stroke, okay? You actually need to lift and come off the ground so the feet can rotate. See, you load on the right foot, you know, like you say, your hips go around, your shoulders go around in the rotation. You know, it's like Federer when he was at his best. The guy started, you know, like open, lifted the left foot, and ended up the forehand facing the left side of the court, the left fence. So it was a total rotation. And of course, you know, you are talking, it depends how people view it. If you view tennis as hitting, okay, but then of course you're going forward, but you're actually pulling from the racket. The best players get close enough to the ball so they can pull from the racket and rotate to the left. That is the most efficient way. Maybe I didn't make it so clear.
My concern or my interest in it is because I can see videos, I can see things, and if the feet are not perfectly open up to that line, then that's not, and to me, I just see that it's more, to me, it's not, it's, there's a little leeway when we say open stance. I think people get caught up. I just can't see everything as being open like that. I can see it being close to it. But I can see it being close to it, but I see there's got to be variables there between that open, between that semi-open and open. There's some variance there. Yeah, we're still open stance. You're not getting me wrong. I'm not saying closed stance at all, but it's not that open where we're open. To me, it's all on the hip, and it all starts from the ground, but there's variables there. There's variables there. You can't just say, It's got to be this, because it's just got to be variables. It has to be variables there.
Yes, but that is exactly what conventional tennis is doing. It doesn't make it variable. It has to be, you know, a little bit, you know, you say sideways, a little bit, not. Okay, so what happens is, to correct those things, I make people go put the right foot, for right-handers, the right foot in front, the left foot in the back a little bit, and that increases actually the power and the toughness. So if more than open stance is super open, you know, the right foot in front, the left foot in back.
Wait a minute. Are you telling me, are you saying now that you're even going past, you're even taking, now you're going to load with the right leg above the left. You're loading with the right leg. You're coiling. You're loading with the right leg above the
leg in front of the left leg. Instead of the left leg, you know, in front is the other one. You load like that, and you keep it, and you pull it back. That gives you the best rotation of the body that generates more power and more tossing. Okay, and that is completely, and I'm not saying that so much in public because they think I'm crazy already. So good. Okay, so you wanted to know my viewpoint, I'm giving my viewpoint. Whether we agree or disagree, I don't need to agree with it. Okay,
I'm not going
to agree with.
Okay, I'm not going to disagree because I by playing basketball and by doing other sports, I actually, this is why I said that there is variables. because that variable can be in front as much as it can be behind, because that variable can be lots of times that you can be positioned or have to hit a ball that your right leg, even this is why I say people don't notice it, because your right leg is actually in front of your left leg and you are open stance. It's very, very possible. Because there's variables.
Yeah, so you can see how Roger Federer has been influenced by coaching, so with Djokovic. But all these kids from Serbia, from Belgrade, started with my technique. The coaches learned that in 1991. They had one book, one of my books that were distributed in the coaches. The same thing happened in Moscow. You know, and Susa can tell you. But to give you an example, whether what I'm proposing is efficient and whether it gives you good results, from this academy in Moscow, one lady that was teaching that to all these 5, 6, 7, 8-year-old girls, you know, they got a large group of these girls, and this was researched, by the way, also by John Carpenter, you can tell you, because in other people. Okay, this lady, okay, was teaching me like that in 1990, 91, 92, 93. In 2003, these girls from, they were older, and five of those girls from the same academy being taught exactly that were in the top 10 in the world. Two played the final of the U.S. Open. One won the French Open. All the girls from the same academy. How can you get, you know, five girls from one country dominate, you know, to the point they have five players in the top 10? Okay, so this, I'm not talking about something that has not been proven. My stuff has been proven. Quarantin was number one in the world. He beat Agassi, he beat Sampras. Okay? He became number one. And here is a kid from a little telephone company club becoming number one in the world. It's a revolution. This girl from Russia. And then I tell you from, you know, also from Serbia. You know, Belgrade, they were teaching my techniques in 1991. That's when they had the first book, and they couldn't find more books because all those 3,000 books I have made were sold out. But in 1992, I published my second book that was like the first one, but more elaborate, more a little bit more edited and with professional pictures. So we're talking, I'm not trying to discuss, you know, here, you know, that my way is right. I just produce good results. And like in every profession, you judge something from the result. You know? If you, yeah.
And I think that you said, I think that anybody that's listening, that any of the listeners and people who have listened before that look at the MTM, I think that you said something that was, it's a very powerful statement. And I think that people who are I'm pretty straight. People who are critics of you don't give you enough credit for saying. You said something that I'm not telling you my way is perfect. It works for me, and that's very, very powerful to me. By saying that because people should realize that there are multiple ways of doing things, and what worked for one person on certain situations might not work for another. But that doesn't mean that it's bad. That doesn't mean it's good.
I totally agree. And then Wes, now I think we've said enough for today. And then you can continue with all the other parts of the show and discussing with Susan. But it's wonderful, and thank you for the opportunity to talk and bring into the open what I think. But we could be arguing for this. I think I said enough, and now go back, and then, yeah, you have some guests also.
And I will
talk to you in the next couple of days, and then we'll make, you know, decisions about another.
Thank you very much.
All right,
Oscar.
Bye-bye. Good night,
Oscar.
Good night. Bye-bye, Susan. Good night.
Susan. That was,
hey,
oh,
there, bro.
Always, so Oscar's always entertaining. And, you know, that was some good stuff. I mean, I think, you know, he clarified a lot of stuff and answered a lot of questions that, you know, certain critics have of different things. And, you know, it's a good perspective, and it's good to hear, you know, it's good to hear from the man himself. You know, it's good to hear, you know, his thought process of the natural. And, you know, it was pretty good. You know, I thought it was good stuff there. Good stuff.
Yeah, I think it's good for, you know, instead of thinking what somebody thinks, why don't you go to the source and actually ask him? And that's what I did in 2004. And is he'll tell you, I used to call and bug him constantly. I'd watch a section, and then the next day I would call him and have a list of questions. And the guy sat through there and answered every question of mine. Says, well, this is this, and this is, I believe this. And I, you know, I took myself out of myself and started to look at it from his perspective and gained new insights, and very helpful, and has radically changed my approach to doing a lot of things in this world. So I'm very grateful for him. But we've got other guests to talk to tonight and get perspective on for coaches.
Yes, we do. We've got two people that I have a lot of respect for. Two parents. Parents that have two kids, actually they both had two kids that are great tennis players. They both were at the highest level. They both were reaching for the highest level performance. They're both supportive of their kids. They're both parents. I'm not going to say they're both parent coaches. Well, I mean, one of them knows my theory is the parent is always the coach, no matter what it is. The parent is always the coach. But we've got two parents that are very heavily involved, very knowledgeable about the sport, very knowledgeable about the system of the sport, and also very knowledgeable about one thing that I think that sometimes coaches seem to forget or don't seem to understand. They're knowledgeable about what they expect as a parent, from a coach for their child. You know, I think a lot of times we coaches, we tend to put ourselves, what we want to contribute or what we think we should be doing to the child. That's what we want, and we tend to do that. And I sometimes wonder what parents think. So I thought it would be great for us today to have two parents that I know that are credible, two parents that have high-quality kids, two parents that have high-quality knowledge about tennis, and two parents that I know that also spend the money, the investment in their child to get what they need. What are they expecting from us? And what do they want at the end of the day when this is all said and done? What do they want their kids? What do they want out of tennis? What do they want to see? What would be the perfect result? Besides, everyone wants to go to the pros, but besides that, what is the result that they want from a good coach? Where would they say, coach, great, good job? We have Felicia and Charles. Susan, you go ahead and handle that.
Hi there, guys. How are you?
Hey, Susan. How are you?
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing fine. So enlighten us. My son only played tennis for a small amount of time, and he's too much like his dad and is going to be probably an engineer. And so he wasn't really into tennis. So I haven't gone through the journey like you all have. So put me in you all's and in your shoes as the mom and as a dad about when you go and you talk to a coach and what you're looking for out of the coach, your communication with the coach. I mean, I want to hear both of your all's perspective. You know, sometimes the mom has a very different perspective than the dad. So, you know, Felicia, why don't you start it, and then Charles will come in on it. But how do you view all that?
Hi, Susan. Thanks for having me on the call. What do we expect in a coach? A local coach, you know, we've been to Florida this past summer for 5 weeks at the Gomez Academy, where both the boys train for 1 month every single day. We love the coaches in Florida. They're very serious. They're putting good work ethic. Some of, you know, the things that I look for in a coach, especially having two young boys, 7 and 10, definitely technique. You know, is the coach showing them the right technique? Or are they, you know, enforcing the right technique? Are they, you know, repeating the right technique? You know, at 7 and 10, you might tell them one day and they forget the next day. You know, it's very repetitive at that age, I think. And a lot of times the local coaches here in Oklahoma, I feel like they tell them one time and it goes in the one ear and goes out the other ear. And then we constantly feel like we have to ask them again. It's like, you know, can you work a little bit more in the forehand or you can work a little bit more in the backhand? I feel like they're trying to either not offend the kid or not offend us, but we're there paying so that our kids can get better, to get to the next level. And we're not offended as parents or as a mom. You know, A, if you need to yell at them if they're not working hard that day, or B, if they're not doing the right thing like they should be. You know, they're only kids, 7 and 10. They need constant reminders. That's my personal take on coaches. I feel like a lot of times they're afraid to speak their mind and afraid to either offend the kids or us, at least locally.
Okay, Charles, give me your take on all that.
You know, thanks for having me on the call, and I appreciate being invited. And I'm learning a lot from the comments. In terms of the coaching, you know, me having one that's now 15 and one that's 9, and noticing different skill levels, different attitudes, understanding at this point that I just want the coach to, number one, allow my child to be the best he can be. And whichever way he's able to communicate, or my child better understands the communication of what you want done, the more effective you're going to be for him. And I've found that, you know, they'll come in and they want to treat every kid the same. They want to put every kid through the same process. And I have one that's just kind of like a tough as nails. And I have one that I feel is extremely a lot more gifted, but he's not mentally as tough as the other one. I mean, he is not, and I get that. But what I've learned from watching them both, that if you take a little time with the younger one, he actually learns faster. And the other one, you got to learn how to motivate my kid. So let's say, for instance, if you got 10 kids, I don't want him, because he's going to be kind, to be pushed to the side. Caleb, who is very talented, a lot of times they would, as soon as he comes to the clinic, they put him with like a smaller girl. So because they put him with a smaller girl, he would be nice to her, and he wouldn't try to hit the ball too hard to her. He wouldn't try to just beat her in the pavement. He'd be kind, which is what you're supposed to be. And he'd wind up in the lower group until ultimately one day he plays somebody that's tougher and he feels like he should be a lot tougher on, and then they want to move him around. And so what winds up happening is he winds up getting thrown to the dogs, so to speak, and the little one being so talented out of the gate, who's going to come out there, who is not as mentally tough, but he's going to come out there and try to rip your head off immediately, he'll get pushed to the front. And there needs to be a better process of determining what this kid needs. And the stroke piece, I kind of feel, is a secondary to the mental piece. Mentally, as they get into the sport and they're learning and it's a new environment, there needs to be a way to allow him to show who he is and at the same time grow as a tennis player. So I run into all different kinds, and we've been all over Atlanta, and there's all different kinds of mindsets that I'm seeing, and I'm like, man, this is really destructive. So there needs to be a lot done in that area. What is you all's take on that?
Well, you know, it's funny. I've seen everything. I've seen you know, I've seen coaches take it from the mindset of, you know, what Felicia described, probably more locally, that, you know, the coaches are a little bit intimidated to really say what's on their mind or be direct, because they don't want to lose a client, and they're worried the parents will talk to somebody else because maybe, you know, you're not the right coach for them, but you're trying to make a paycheck. work so you can pay bills and all that. And then I think you have the flip side of the coin of coaches trying to be brutally honest and wanting to work with the parents. And, you know, some parents, you know, some coaches, you know, I hear this from because I talk to so many coaches coast to coast, have saying, you know, I'm trying to give the parents an honest assessment of what's going on, and they're looking at me like I'm delusional, like I'm crazy. And, you know, they're throwing their hands up in the air and going, well, I don't know what to say. And I guess, you know, I try to be a humanist and be honest, but kind of, you know, with the parents, be realistic, but try to give it in a very kind of way and try to, you know, and motivate, and like you said, you know, motivate and inspire the kids to want to be more and to want to put out more effort. And, you know, the kids that I found, that I've had some kids that I thought just struggled athletically or lacked so much confidence, all of a sudden, you know, you can give them a little nurturing and then they developed. And, you know, I think there's a lot of the ones that are in the coaching forum tend to be more in that realm that they want to do a good job. It's just, I feel bad for, I mean, you're in Atlanta, if I do recall, Charles, so, you know, there are some good quality, lots of good quality coaches there, but I feel bad for Felicia that she feels like that she has to go down to Florida to get what she wants. I mean, I would hope that, you know, you could find something that, you know, someone in Oklahoma, someone closer to home that could give you what you want.
Possibly Tulsa Academy in Tulsa, Susan, but that's an hour and a half away, and the cost of trips is high, so we might as well just go to Roma climbing, visit family, and kiddo tennis in at the same time.
Well.
Let me kind of address something that I thought of what Charles was saying. I think one thing that happens, especially with coaches, is a lot what Susan says, that I think in overall in sports, as far as the coaching and everything, you're only as good as your experience. I think that because tennis can be such a big recreational sport, especially when it becomes to an adult, and it can be a very lucrative sport when you have an adult, that coaches that really aren't qualified to really address junior competitive tennis or don't understand competition or competitive world of sports, because it is a different world. It's a different training. It's a different perspective of a kid. It's a different pushing of a kid. It's a different drawing your kid out. It's a mentality more so where I'm not trying to be your friend. I don't care about being. I'm trying to make you a good tennis player, and it's that raw. It's whatever works. If today I have to give you a lollipop to get you to motivate, that's fine. Whatever it takes for me to get you out, whatever it takes for me to get the energy out of it, I have to be that creative. I can't sit and look, okay, this is what I learned, this is what the book says, so then I become isolated, I only do this. So now there's thousands of kids, and most of the time they're athletic kids that you can't touch, because those athletic kids need more. They might need more pushing, they may need more discipline, they may need this, but there's some way that it offsets that you've got to go outside the boundary. And if you haven't experienced athletics, or if you haven't been to season, you've experienced it, so it doesn't, it fits right into your norm. But if you just picked up tennis and you just started coaching tennis at 35 and you really played no sports, but now you're coaching tennis and you've got a junior that's 15, 14, he's playing a high-level tournament, he loses, what do you say to him? You don't really know. I'm just being honest. You've never played a 14 sport in your life. You don't know. You don't really. There's a disconnect there. You don't know what to say to that child. You're saying what a book told you, which is only giving you the perspective of that whatever that teacher wrote in that book. He's looking at one client. Well, there's got to know how to ad lib that. You got to know how. I mean, many times I've had in my mind what I was going to say to a child after they lost. But by the time I got to him, I had to change it. Why? Because the child's expression, he came up the court happy with himself. When he came up the court, listen, I did. He hit me differently than what I thought. So, by being in sports, I realized, okay, this is not the best time to do it. Why? Because I don't want to. I don't want to bring him down, or I don't want to compound the issue. Or he's feeling good about something about the match, even though I thought it was crappy. For some reason, it made him get confidence. I mean, it happened. I've seen it where, you know, he made the worst match with that. He come off like, man, I feel I played great. I was hitting this. Now, do you sit and say, well, you played crappy, or do you capitalize off of that momentum that you have? Well, if you play sports, you don't know what the word momentum means, because it's all about momentum, and it's all about children. It's all about the kids. And this is just my belief, and lots of coaches don't have my belief. My belief is, no matter how much money me as a parent has, my child is poor, meaning that I'm investing in you so that you can have the opportunity to get ahead in life. I'm teaching you how to play tennis so you can get ahead in life. Not to be a pro, but to go to college free, to make something of it. Because, I'm honest, this is America. Teachers get paid $100,000. An athlete makes that one game. Let's be realistic. Who makes – and I just say that some coaches have the wrong idea that I think parents expect good kids. And I think coaches are wrong when they think that parents should not expect my kid to be good. I'm giving you $100 an hour. I expect for my kid to be good. I ain't going to say he's supposed to be perfect, but I expect for him not to lose every match. I mean, I expect to see results. And I think coaches then stop putting kids into tournaments. This is why I look at there's a national junior tournament coming up. There's a national scrum coming up here in Macon next weekend. There's kids at that. It's a national level 2, and it's a section level 1. There's kids in that tournament that are almost 2,000 national. How can a kid be ranked 2,000 national? Get into a national tournament? Why? Because they only had 120. They only had 124 kids. Only had 24 kids.
Wow.
Hey, can I interject something? I want to ask this question to the coaches as well. It's been rare, because the one thing I do know is I don't know tennis as well as some of the coaches, but I do know my kid better than any person in the world. How come sometimes we'll go to a place and the first thing they want to do is put the kid on the court, instead of even just giving me a little survey or giving a little time and say, what kind of kid do you have? How does he learn best? What motivates him?
Okay, Wes, can I answer this?
I can't. Listen, when he said I just sat back and got my Charles. This was something that, I'm going to be honest with you, Charles, I learned from her.
Yeah.
I learned this from Susan, to ask Wes to get to know the history of what you're going to look at before you get a picture of it, to try to know something about it. I'll let Susan answer that. I agree with you, sir. I agree with you 1,000%. I agree.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and it's, you know, Wes will tell you, it's one of my biggest pet peeves is I like to know the kid, and I like to interact with the kid and know what they, you know, a little bit about who they are, what do they like in school, you know, why do they like that, you know, ask them questions and figure out not only their learning modality and the mm-hmm. and you know, I have a learning disability, so I definitely have learn crazy one way and the other way I'm completely horrible, but you know, and to learn how they're wired, you know, if they're fine motor skilled, if they're major motor, you know, watching them and observing them. And I find it really odd, too, that people don't take the time to have a conversation. I mean, I have people come while I'm working behind the desk in Beaumont, and I'll have them come and spend, you know, 20, 30 minutes talking to me on an off day before I even have their lessons, because I want to know the kid. And I want to know the family, and I want to know the support system. So why don't people do that? I have not, you know, I don't have a clue. Maybe they feel under time crunch or I don't know. But to me, it's a critical part, because I want to go on the court. And my philosophy is, if you don't get something, if the kid doesn't get something, it's not their fault, it's my fault. because I should know how they're wired. I should know how to effectively communicate with them. I should be the expert in that so that I can help them be more so I can be more efficient and more effective delivering it to them so they can get it, so we can get this skill mastered as quickly as possible and as effectively as possible and go to the next thing. And so, yeah, I wonder that too, my friend. I really do. And, you know, if I was in Atlanta, I'd give you a big hug right now. But, yeah, I agree with you 110%.
Yeah, because let me tell you this. I'm going to take one of my kids in there, and he's not going to show you anything on day one. Even though he can do it, he's just not going to show it because he naturally does not like to be in a bunch of crowds. Now, you let him, after about two times, okay, different. Then I have another one who is terrified that he don't know what's going to happen, and he can play very well. And I mean, he's my younger one. But the thing is, if he does not feel, or if he feels in any way that you're going to put him on the spot and he might get embarrassed, he's going to start clamming up on you.
Uh-huh.
And so you never really got to see him. And, every time I go there and these people are like, well, let's do an assessment. You haven't even asked me about my kid. I mean,
yeah,
whether he can hit a ball or not is not going to be determined today, because guess what? He doesn't know you. You don't know him. He's nervous. He wants to impress you. And I'm like, stop that. You know?
Sure.
I mean,
have
I
you ever tried talking to the coaches ahead of time before you even get there? I've learned to make a little list of the questions I like to ask the coaches before I get to the first lesson or first academy. Kind of screen the coaches to see if it's a good fit for you, first of all. Couple videos of your son and then send it down to the coaches and let them assess it, online first before you even get there.
I feel like it's the coach's responsibility to ask for certain things. It's not for me, because what I'm nervous about a little bit is that coach will take my questions. He would look at my videos, or say he looked at them because he's trying to make a paycheck. I want him to be asking me the questions off the rip, so I understand that, yes, I want to do a great job, and that's all I want from my coach. I mean, he's not going to be perfect. He's not going to do everything right, but I want to know, hey, you know what, Mr. Strother, I want to do a great job with your kids, whatever that means. And, you know, I experienced it for the first time when I went down to Texas with Houston and I met John Wilkerson. And for those who may not know, he coached Zena Garrison and Lori McNeil. And before he ever let Caleb get on the court, the first thing he said to me was, I need to sit down and talk to Caleb. Is that all right with you? And I said, sure. And he sat there for 45 minutes and just talked to him. And he said, yes, this young fella can go on the courts, and here's where I'm going to place him. And it changed my whole thinking pattern. Then little Joshua is very talented. He can just go get on the court and hit when he wants to. He's too young for me to push him. Just let him do what he wants. If he wants to play, he plays. If he doesn't, he doesn't. And let him develop a love and a thirst for the game. But that was the first coach that sat down and said, let me talk to your kid.
I agree. I'll say this, and just to, as a devil advocate of myself, I'll say for small coaches, I've noticed, and I've seen that a lot of times, a lot of coaches don't want to get attached to kids. Why? Because parents because coaches get attached to kids. It always happens. The coaches get attached to kids. They start liking the kid, and the kid excels. But the parent does something and take the kid or whatever, and the parent doesn't realize that the coach has gotten attached to that child. A coach that really cares for a child, a child that excels really quick, you can always see when a coach cares for him. Parents are entitled to make bad decisions, and some do. Mm-hmm. And a lot of coaches, so now some coaches, I've noticed that they are protective about their personal feelings, meaning, I don't want to get too attached to you. Why? I get to like you, because now it becomes a mental roller coaster. And I can tell you from experience, it is a hurtful feeling to have put yourself into a child, and the child is actually the top of their game and going, and then something, whatever happens, the child is going, and the parent acts like it's a hurtful feeling, especially when you attach to that child. I mean, I've had that feel. Mm-hmm. I've had that feeling because some coaches get into kids. I mean, when I coach, I get into a child. I mean, I get into it. It's a hurting feeling, and I think, and I've learned that no matter what hurting feeling it is, you've got to hurt that feeling, but you still got to do the same child the next way, or else you hurt yourself as a coach. The reason that you coach is because you can that you, because you have that attribute. As soon as I started saying, well, I'm not going to get close to the kid, I stopped connecting to all kids, and that was bad. So I just had to do it. I'm just going to get hurt every time. I'm just going to have to say, well, I hope this time don't work. Why? Because that's a part of me. I've seen a lot of coaches that it happened so much that they became hard. Just me, myself, have realized that, okay, yeah, I'm protecting myself, but I'm hurting my job. I'm hurting my industry. I'm hurting my brand. I'm hurting my results. I care more about results than my pride. So meaning, hey, I'm just going to get hurt. Why? I can't walk around like this. You know, I just can't. And that's part of me. I'm no kids. Because I would fail a test when they ask you to make it. I got nicknames for kids. Listen, I don't know. Now I'm playing. I'm ripping and running. I get attached to my kids. So that's how I can feel for you. I can understand you. I can see how you move. I can understand what pulls your buttons, what makes you tick, what makes you this. Because every kid is different. Every kid is different. You know.
I feel like sometimes the local coaches want to keep the good players to themselves. Even though that player might have outgrown you, they're like, you know, there could be a better facility or better coaches or better whatever, and they're like, they don't really want the parent to go check out another facility or go check out a different coach, whatever, in fear of losing that, you know, star student, whatever. But maybe that's the best thing for that student.
But the long run, the parent, the child leaves anyway because the same reason that child came to that coach. That child is going to want to go. That child is going to want to win. Why? Because if they're getting that good, they're going to want to win, and eventually they're going to lose. They're going to leave. They're going to leave you now for losing. I've learned that it's better to develop a relationship with them. Hey, listen, you know, I think you got here. I want you to go to my man. I want to pass you on to my man. So now the child doesn't leave you. So now you don't have a sense of being left. You don't have a sense of, you know, they're just going down. Now you develop a relationship. Why? Because it comes back, because that child needs something more to me, develop a relationship where, I mean, I've had kids where I send them to Jeanette's, I send them to different places, but yes, they come to hit with me. But why? Well, I need him to get match play. I can't give him that. I need him to get this hit. I'm 40-some years old now. I can't get this hit and play, so I got to send him there. Well, do I see him? Yes, but we're on different, the structure of how the development changes now. As they get older, their needs get different. Their things. So you, become more of a consultant. You know, you become more of a consultant, but you're still in mix with some coaches. They hold the kid back, and the child ends up going anyway. And I mean, child ends up going anyway.
I agree with that. I have found that you know, a lot of coaches want to think that they can do everything, and sometimes, you know, I mean, I've coached at all levels, and I prefer to be at the development. It's not like I haven't coached D1 tennis. It's not like I haven't worked with a pro player. It's not like, you know, that I haven't. But I prefer, and I know what I'm really, really good at. And when they get to a certain level, I can do it. But I prefer say, hey, I can do this, you know, but I think that person would be better for you. And like you said, be in a mentorship role, and I have several kids that I had a kid up to Beaumont the other day. I work with her a little bit, but I'm more of her head coach, and getting her some match play and stuff, because, you know, I'm sort of like the other adult male figure in her life. And I think sometimes for coaches it's hard because they do care. And I think, you know, but I think it's important for them to let them go and let them fly. And I don't, you know, and I, you know, it's, it, it's, you know, and that's how I view it. And I don't really lose a kid. I, you know, gain a different relationship. I mean, heck, I still talk to my first coach I ever had.
That's a good way to look at it. You know, and even not to get on Felicia's thing, and this is, I can't say it's a problem. It is a problem, but this is something that has to grow, and the industry has to grow, is location. Location in tennis is more important than any sport that I have seen. I mean, just that location. Golf. I've seen people, the love of golf, I've seen people, they go out and play in golf and anything. Tennis is a little different, and I just think that location, one of the things that's hurting, that hurts Felicia is from what she's wanting and what needing is location, is her location. And I would have to agree with her, and to honesty, I would rather take my, if it costs me the same amount to go to Florida, where now I have a chance to, I have the world at me, where in Oklahoma, I'm going to pay this money, but I'm still leading it to where I can grow. If I go to Florida, I might be in the right place, the right time, and my son might get to hit this coach, this person. It's all who you know, what to know. I have a better chance at getting more advanced stuff, getting more stuff, getting seen more than paying it to my locals, paying it to this, driving over here. Wow, because I have no growth. I have no growth, and it's all about growth. I mean, to me, especially the tennis world, it's all about growth and knowing someone that cares, or getting around the top players, or getting around those players, those people that have the same mindset that you have. Because, I mean, even in Florida, the tennis industry is such a thing between parents, it is a soap opera within itself. I mean, and people don't understand that the tennis industry is a very, very nice industry. I mean, you see parents, and most of it comes from parents. You know, parents want to win so bad, they do things. It's just
Some of the parents pay $50,000 to $70,000 a year. They're expecting results a year per child.
That's right, and I agree. And now if the coach doesn't,
and some of them just aren't that good.
You got to know when to. Hey, listen, you got to go here. But I think that a lot of it has to do. I mean, I'm lucky in New Jersey. Even though when I was in New Jersey, even though it's a colder climate, New Jersey is a very big tennis state, though. It's very big in tennis. You've got indoor courts and stuff. Here in Georgia is a very big tennis state for juniors. But when you get out of juniors, now when you start talking about getting out of juniors, Georgia is not the best. It's great, but to me, this is my opinion, the mentality of coaches in Georgia are not to that next level, pro level, get there. Why? Because I just don't think that they've experienced that kind of high performance, it's a business. Like, this is a business. You have to start thinking, it's a business when you start up there. And these kids deserve, you know, if your parents are spending, if I'm spending $100,000 with you, and you're sitting there telling me, okay, well, you know, now I'm going to get serious with them, or, you know, don't worry, you know, I'm spending $100,000. If my kid can't get out of a level four, Something wrong. There's no account. And I'm not saying that. And to me, the answer to it is it starts with coaches accepting reality. Reality of what level. It's okay to be a level. Just like Susan, I call and ask Susan all kind of questions from all kind of different kids. I know Susan loves ROG. Susan loves under 10th grade. But it doesn't stop me from calling her and asking about an 18th question. Why? Because she knows. But I know also what she loves. For me, I'm getting to know younger kids. Why? Because I'm a talker. I'm constantly pushing you. I'm a little bit better with older kids, or after you've gotten to know me, you'll see, okay, he's nothing but a big old kid and stuff, and that's why I've had to grow to learn. I've had to grow to learn to deal with younger kids, because some styles are not good for younger kids, because we don't look at them as how fragile, how some younger kids are not. They're not soft, they're not quitter, but they're still younger kids, because society makes us think younger kids are supposed to be so hard, so tough, when they're actually young. I mean, to see a 9-year-old kid be 9-year-old is rare today. It's rare today.
Yeah.
It's rare. It's rare.
Yeah.
You know? And,
yeah. And see, that whole thing you're saying is all absolutely true. And learning the kid and also what goes on in the market and what goes on with the parents. Because, see, the parents, believe it or not, have an extremely difficult job, whether you're paying, you know, $100 a year or $100,000 a year. And all you want really is to say, right now I don't care about, you know, you being honest with me about what you think my kid can do, because the reality is any kid can blossom late or early. But can you just help him be the best he can be? And
yep.
We're comfortable with that. At least I am. I mean, I'm extremely comfortable with that. Help him be the best that he can be.
That's good. That's kind of the way that it. I mean, the way to me, it's to me. I guess that's a little different. And not just, I want to say, Mr. Me, my goal is to make you the best that you can be. And that's kind of. I mean,
yeah.
I hope that. I mean, I try to put that into my scenarios. I hope the best that you can be. But and having to understand reality is that every kid, some kids are going to be here, some kids are going to be there. But it's the best that you can be. And it's all about the best, making a child want to have a good effort. I mean, that's something that I try to do, because it's all about an effort. I mean, because I've seen kids, people say they're a bad kid. No, they're not a bad kid. You couldn't get there. It's all how you relate to these kids. I'm just, I hate to say this in this industry, and I know coaches will be mad at me, but the kid is the product, not the coach. I do know the coach is there, but the kid is the product. I understand how coaches feel when they say they feel they're the product. But once a coach starts feeling they're the product, then there's something wrong, because the kid is the product. So you got to now mold. You got to go outside the box. I mean, people ask me once, why you wear these clothes to practice? Well, I might get on the floor, act like a donkey. If we get that kid to run, I'll run a lap.
Yeah.
That kid. I'll run like damn. I tell you, listen, people sit there and listen. I'm very agile. If you seem like I can't, I'll flip it and go right to something else to get you smiling, to get you going. Why? Because that's how they learn. That's how they learn. That's how it's learning. Learning is fun, and then keep right on going. Hey guys, we went over. We have the child of police, and we definitely want to have you guys back, because I wanted to talk a little bit about the fundraising idea that the fundraising ideas that we've come up with, just shoot some out there. We just have time to address that, because we're going to be going in a few minutes here. I just want to thank Charles and Felicia. I really want to thank you guys for joining us tonight and giving your insight, giving some honest insight. You know, lots of times us coaches, we live in our own, some of us, we live in our own little, me too, we live in our own little bubble, thinking that we know it all, or we are it. You know, we are it. And we never stop to realize what parents want out of the child. And, you know, we always think you want us to be a father figure or a role model or life lesson, when sometimes you just want exactly what I'm paying you for. Teach my child how to be a good tennis player. And sometimes we coaches get lost in the fact that parents have expectations, and parents have right to have expectations, and parents have right to make mistakes too with the child, with their children, and they do. I mean, and that happens. And I want to thank you guys for coming out and sharing some of your stories and some of your experiences with us. And you know, I just want to say thank you, Susan.
Yeah, thank you both for coming on, and I really do appreciate it on giving on your insight and your devotion to your kids, and thank you, and hopefully if you guys ever get a chance to come down to Houston or to Tennis Paradise in Beaumont, you'll stop on by and say hi.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Oh dear. And Charles, are you on Facebook? You can send me.
I'm on there. I have my son's name on there, but I'm on Facebook, and it's Caleb Strother, Strother.
Strother, okay.
C-A-L-E-P?
C-A-L-E-P?
Yes, C-A-L-E-B.
E-B,
S-T-R-O-T-H-E-R,
okay.
Yeah.
Got it. I'll look you up.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I mean, anytime. I mean, feel free to reach out.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Scott. Thanks, Sean. Thanks, Felicia. Well, Susan.
You guys are awesome. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Have a good night.
Okay. Good night.
Okay. You too.
This was a good start to the new show, to the new season. We got some good ones coming up. You know, you tell me about some good ones you got lined up. We know we're gonna have Gayla Black. We're gonna have, you know, the young Tornado Black. We're gonna be there. We're gonna have her as a guest. You know, we're gonna have my man, our good buddy, and our good friend to the show, Dave Smith. So we should have some really good interesting this year. You know, you're gonna have your open house, and then we know you're gonna have. I hear about this women's only thing where I'm supposed to just come. I can't say nothing. Just you. It's just gonna be all about women. Tennis, and I just cannot, and I'm supposed to be like, listen, I am spoken to when I'm asked a question. Oh, I just cannot wait for this, a bunch of ladies here in the studio and just telling us about women's tennis and giving us a female coach's perspective with something that I think the tennis industry has to address immediately. I'm not going to get into it, you know what I'm saying, but I think it's something that it's a quiet killer. I think that it's a silent killer, and the more that festers on, and the more that these issues and ladies and these things are not put into light, the further it's going to gradually it's going to hit, and we're not going to have a way to come back from it. That's just the way I look at it. But Susan, we got to wrap up before we get kicked out of this radio, put out of the studio. But I just want to say thanks. Good show, Susan, and I'll talk to you later. Susan, take it away.
All right, Wes, thank you. Thank you to our guest and to Oscar and to Felicia and to Charles. Thank you for kicking off our 2016 campaign. And, Wes, we're going to have a lot of fun this season. So looking forward to having more time with you on the radio. Take it away, Wes.
All right, Susan. Good night, everyone, and have a good night here from Just Tennis Talk Radio Show. Good night. Thank you.
Good night.